Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality they see below the surface.
That's right. And there's going to be three of us today. This is our 100th episode, if you can believe it.
Huzzah!
Wonderful. 4 years we've been doing this, our 100th yeah. episode. We have with us today Brother Guy Consolmagno. He was born in Detroit, Michigan. Earned an undergraduate and master's degree in Earth and Planetary Sciences from MIT and a PhD in Planetary Science from the University of Arizona. He took vows as a Jesuit brother in 1991 and has been with the Vatican Observatory since 1993. And he's also a science fiction fan.
Mm-hmm.
When he's not busy with the Vatican's meteorite collection at Castel Gandolfo or the Vatican's telescopes in Tucson, Arizona, he's often found convincing people that science and religion are perfectly compatible. And he's written some wonderful books that address this very issue, like Brother Astronomer, Adventures of a Vatican Scientist, God's Mechanics, How Scientists and Engineers Make Sense of Religion, and his latest, which he wrote with fellow Vatican scientist Father Paul Muller, is Would You Baptize an Extraterrestrial? And Other Questions from the Astronomer's Inbox at the Vatican Observatory. Welcome, Brother Guy. Thank you for coming.
It's a delight to be here with you guys.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Julie and I both read Would You Baptize an Extraterrestrial? And I, for one, thought it was terrific. It's interesting that question sort of symbolizes someone trying to imply that, you know, from a cosmic perspective, Christianity has no value or no meaning. And the entire book is really about the relationship between science and religion and how there shouldn't be any kind of a barrier there. So I really loved it. It's one of my—
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
I did too, because mm-hmm. I loved the way that you would take a question like that, or the, I believe there were 7 or 9 questions, something like that.
6 questions and a day to rest.
Well, okay. See, I should have really looked at the book before I started talking, but I did read it. Mm-hmm. And but what I loved is the way you would take each question and say, here's what they're really asking. Because, of course, we all kind of know that, but to really talk about it. So that was really wonderful.
It's fun to actually dig at the questions themselves and try to figure out, because the thing with questions that people are always asking, if they're always asking them, means that the answers they're getting aren't satisfying them. And maybe we're not answering the question they really want to have answered.
Yeah, and I appreciate this so much. In fact, last night I was doing an inquiry group, and they asked a question that I had read in your book. So I was like, I happen to have a very good answer for that.
Right.
What was it?
It was fantastic. They were just talking about religion and science in general. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, well, how can you believe this and that? And someone was describing their meandering path to where we were at last night and just saying, well, I decided that science was really the thing, but then I sort of decided that maybe science wasn't really the thing. And I was just trying to explain, you know, it's both things.
Yes, right.
You know, it's not one or the other. It can be both.
And of course, that really goes back to something that a philosophy professor once told me, which was that in life there are two kinds of questions. There's the how much money do I have in my pocket? Is it enough for a candy bar? And once you have the answer to that, it's a boring question. But there are other questions that are always going to be with you, and even after you solve them once, they come back, like, what kind of candy do I want to buy? Or why do I love chocolate? And these are the questions that you don't answer, but that you live with. These are the questions that, you know, in the words of the gospel, these are the sorts of things that Mary would carry with her in her heart. And those are the fun questions. Those are the ones that you can talk about forever and never get tired of.
Which is kind of a wonderful lead-in into the book you chose, Among Others by Joe Walton.
That's right. We're going to talk about that book, Among Others by Joe Walton. And just as a quick introduction to it, It won the Hugo and the Nebula Award back in 2012, was written in 2011. Joe Walton is a very interesting person. We've talked about her a little bit off and on here. She wrote a book called Why Is This Book So Great?
Yeah.
Which was some of her posts from Tor.com about classic science fiction, which I'm a big fan of. I enjoyed this book immensely. What did you think, Julie?
Immensely is such a big word. You know? I had started it. It was discussed on SFF Audio, and so I started reading it then, and I got partway into it and said, not much is happening, and I stopped reading it. And so then this made me pick it up and read the whole thing, which I did in audiobook format, and I really liked the audio, which has helped me through many a good book, like A Tale of Two Cities and Jonathan Strange and Mr. Gnarl and things like that. And so I was really able to appreciate the book pretty well, but I fall into the 3 out of 5 star groups. And I've noticed when I was looking at the reviews, some people really, really loved it. I think they kind of sank into it, you know, the world and everything. And then there were some people like me who were going, but nothing's happening for so much of the book.
Not much does happen in it. And that's very true.
It's the very beginning and very end, which made me actually stop and start thinking about all the books I love where I've had people tell me that about them. So, you know.
Indeed.
So, I got so many great things in it.
Yeah, go ahead, Brother Guy.
Yeah, I came to this book in an odd way because basically I picked it up and read it because I knew the author. Mm-hmm. And I've known the author for maybe 10 years, long before she was famous.
Neat.
She's been in the science fiction world for a long time, and a mutual friend of ours, a fellow named Bill Higgins, introduced me to her years ago and pointed out a couple of Bill is one of these science fiction fans who knows everyone. And he and his wife have a guest room which has on the shelf the books of all the people who have stayed in that guest room.
Oh,
how neat.
Isn't that wonderful?
That is so cool.
That is great. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's where I first read some of her early fantasies. And these were interesting, but you could still see the training wheels.
Mm-hmm.
And then in around 2004, 2005, she wrote a book that completely changed my understanding of the genre. It was the one about dragons. Oh, what the heck was it? Tooth and Claw.
Tooth and Claw, okay.
Okay.
And I heard her describing how she wrote this book. She was sitting at home. She's originally from Wales, but lives in Canada, lives in Montreal. She was sitting at home reading a copy of Trollope and feeling disgusted and picked up the book and threw it across the room and said out loud, "There is this. The author of this book has no understanding of what women are really like." And her husband sort of shrugged. And a few hours later, she picks up the book she's reading and throws it across the room and says, "The author of this book has no understanding what dragons are really like." And he goes, "There are dragons in Trollope?" Bingo. So she writes a fantasy novel, which is, in fact, could be straight out of something from the 19th century or 18th century. That starts with the funeral, of course, of the grand man of the family, who is, of course, a dragon.
Okay.
And all of the other heirs are arguing over which part of his body they get to eat. And it's such a perfect picture of what those kinds of books are about, where you're consuming those who came before you.
That is great.
And it's hilarious. So, but like most good satires, it loves what it's satirizing. And you can read it both for the amusement factor of, oh, how she did that. Plus, just as a story itself, it's a great story. And it makes you, it takes a genre that you thought you knew and turns it inside out. Hmm. So that was great.
Wow, that is great. I got to read that one.
And she won the World Fantasy Award for that.
Nice. So I can understand it.
Yeah. So the next year she comes out with three more novels. They're in a series. She calls them the Small Change series because one small change in British history sets up this alternate universe of an England that pulls out of World War II and eventually becomes a semi-fascist country.
I've heard of those.
The three books are called Farthing, Halfpenny, and Half a Crown. So it's a small change in British change. And again, the way she sets it up and the way she plays with your expectations and the way that she makes you, of course, in this book, she's not writing about World War II. She's really writing about what was then contemporary politics in Britain in 2007, 2008. Mm-hmm. It was fascinating to see the way that she played with the genres. And I thought this was brilliant. So she's been working on this book, among others. She didn't have a title for it for a long time, and talking about it on her live journal. When the book finally came out, I had to pick it up. And again, reading it, it's like this person has just taken another giant step. Hmm. You know, if only enough people read this book, it could win the Hugo. Well, apparently enough people did, because it did.
It sure did.
Now, but the reason that I brought it up for this particular podcast is, I know, Jo, she's not religious. She never claims to be religious. She's certainly not viciously anti-religious. But her description of magic in this book is the closest description I've ever seen to prayer. And the way the magical world works is a perfect description of how I see the world of prayer working and the world of faith working in my life. And I'm reading it thinking, she's not a believer. She doesn't pray. How does she know this? How did she get this so right?
How fascinating.
Yeah.
Because that never occurred to me. I'm a pretty new Catholic and Christian, I'll just say.
It did occur to me this second time through reading it. Because I read it, I participated in that SFF audio podcast that she mentioned before. And then this time I read it again. And, you know, we mentioned that very little happens in it. But this time when I was reading it, it was probably about, I don't know, 10 or 15% in it that I had a shift in my mind to where I really felt, okay, this is the character writing a journal.
Yeah.
And once I made that connection, I looked at the book completely differently. You know, it may appear really obvious, but for me, when I was reading it, somehow I wasn't making that connection. And then mm-hmm. once I did that, the thing that you just said actually really came to the light pretty quickly. There's a moment early in the book where her and her sister were trying to do something to a factory. They were trying to crumble it. Right. And they did some kind of a magic spell or whatever. And then she said, I actually have it highlighted here. She said, I thought the flowers would dissolve and ripples would spread out and then it would crumble to ruin. And the trees and ivy come swarming over it while we watched and the pool would become real water. And the bird would come and drink from it and the fairies would be there and thank us and take us all to a palace. And then she expected that instantaneous gratification of what she was asking for. And then a tiny bit later, she says it had worked, though. The next day, the headline in the Leader was Furnacite Plant Closing, Thousands of Jobs Lost. And that's where I first clicked it. Yeah, that's where... Yeah,
that it worked, but also she shows the effects and the incredible chain of effects that every magical step or every prayer involves. Yes, the horrible factory closes. On the other hand, thousands of jobs are lost. A lot of people who lived there suddenly are on the dole. And
right
now, what do you do? Now, what happens?
Mm-hmm.
Well, go ahead.
Which is usually not something that most fantasy writers think to ask. Okay, that was the great fantasy. Now what happens?
Also, partway through the book, I also made that same shift you did, Scott, though much later. When I was finally going, oh my gosh, you know, come on. And then I went, no, it's her journal. Just treat it like Middlemarch. Let it wash over you. And that's when I also was able to appreciate some smaller points. And because I wound up loving Middlemarch. And this book had so many things, moments that were great in it like that, that though the book itself to me as a book is maybe less than compelling, it had great moments like that. And one of the things was that magic has a cost. Yes. And you can't always tell if the cost, if the effect of the magic is just the real world or if it's the magic. Because partway through this book, you're left thinking, she's could be an extremely unreliable narrator. Is she kind of crazy?
Oh, yeah. And
you know,
and there are,
you don't know.
There are people who, you know, read the book and don't think that it's fantasy at all, that it's the diary of, you know, a girl who's been through some sort of terrible trauma. We know she's been through a trauma. You learn early on that mm-hmm. her sister has died and that she's become crippled, that she's run away from home and is wound up living with a father who she never knew, who had abandoned them when they were children, when they were babies. And maybe this is just the you know, craziness of a 15-year-old who's going through serious problems.
Yeah.
And you can read the book that way if you want. And you can, and as she says about the magic, every step along the way, you can deny that it's there. You can say it's just a string of coincidences because
magic
works that way.
Yeah, and you just made me think of one of the things, because I was thinking, wow, that would drain out all the positive good stuff out of this book, right?
It would.
If you thought of it that way. And I was suddenly thinking about, I don't know if you guys have seen Life of Pi.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen it?
I have, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Spoiler to anybody who hasn't seen it. I'm just going to talk about the end for a second. But there's the point where in the explanation, he says, well, you could look at the story like this. And he gives a very mundane explanation, inserting people for animals and all the horridness that happens is just from awful human behavior. And I left that movie and I was so upset.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked my husband, I said, which story did you believe? And he goes, well, I don't know. I guess either one could be true. And I almost started a fight with him right there in the parking lot.
Right.
Going, how could you even believe that real story? And I had to come to a real, I had to come to an understanding within myself saying, it's that same thing you're talking about, Brother Guy. It's how do you see the world and what really happened? Just because that's the story people like to slap on things and that's what he told them, that doesn't really mean that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
He's not crazy.
Yeah, a couple of things that I can add to that from conversations I've had with Joe. First of all, we were talking about another author who we like but who drives me nuts because I like him when I'd really want to love him, and that's Charles DeLint.
Agreed. Yeah.
And she put it perfectly. She says, the trouble with his books is, though, he's a wonderful storyteller. At the end of the day, you don't believe that he actually believes in this stuff.
There's only one of his books I've ever felt that way about that he did.
Yeah.
Invest it with that, and that's The Mystery of Grace.
And all of the other ones, you sort of, he's telling a clever tale.
Yeah.
Whereas this one, you certainly know that the narrator believes that it's true. And Joe says, you know, while I'm writing it, I certainly believe it's true. She's absolutely convinced it's true. She intends the magic to be real. The fairies are real. And the one clue to that is the awful boyfriend towards the end of the book also sees them and experiences them.
Right. I was just thinking that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is
that,
he an
that's
awful
the moment
boyfriend?
When he started to see that, that's when I dropped the notion that maybe it wasn't true.
Yeah.
Because I did have that feeling throughout, you know, maybe, maybe not. But once he started to see them, I decided definitely true.
Although he is an awful boyfriend, and talking to Joe, who says she knows what happens next, but would never write the book. She has no intention of writing the
sequel. Oh, no.
but she knows. Just as you know the backstory. She knows what the horrible thing was that's never revealed that gets her sister killed.
Got it.
That she says, of course, that's a miserable relationship. Of course, it's going to go bad. He's no good. You know, anyone flicking at this stage can look back at it and say, no, she shouldn't be dealing with this guy. He's up to no good. But the
main character, I don't know. It depends on who you believe.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a romantic. I wanted to believe him.
Right. The part of what's fascinating about the book, if there is a flaw to it that I find, it's that the main character, the Mo character, has too many things, has too much character, has too many things going on. It's that she's crippled, that she's lost a sister, that she's got the insane mother. And the only defense is, in fact, these are all the things that are autobiographical. All of these are actually true of Jo.
Oh.
She does have a mother who's insane and institutional.
I didn't know that.
She had a sister who was killed in a car accident. They weren't twins, but there was a very close sister. Mm-hmm. Jo herself walks with a cane to this day because of the accident. She went to a horrible boarding school that she says she'll never tell anyone what school it was because she hated it so much. And an awful lot of the reason that she could put herself into the mind of a 15-year-old in 1979 is that she collected all of her journals from then and was saying, hey, this is who I was and what I was reading and what I was going through at that age.
Well, that's fascinating.
Wow. Well, because that, I was wondering when I was reading it, it was obvious that the books she was talking about, many of which I also love. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's one big attraction for anybody who has any affinity for the book at all is like, oh my gosh, these authors, who doesn't know that thrill of meeting people who also can talk about books with you, of connecting with people like that and then connecting with these authors like that. But I was reading it and I was thinking like her total defense of Tolkien against everyone is part of the 15-year-old psyche. But
absolutely.
I thought, was that Jo? Well, it's also now part of mine since I've listened to him in audio and learned to love him in the last few years. But I kept thinking, is this, how much of this is Jo Walton? Or, you know, you feel that these are books she loves and you wonder, did she defend Tolkien against all comers and that sort of thing? So that's really interesting.
One of the other wonderful twists, of course, the great conceit is here is a girl who experiences fairies, experiences the supernatural, and in spite of that or because of that, loves science fiction, knowing that it's fictional. I mean, she's living in a fantasy world. You'd think she wouldn't need the science fiction, but in fact she does, because science fiction is not an escape. Science fiction is the rule book that helps you put the world together and allows you to understand things. The other twist, which is wonderful and that she does very self-consciously, is that she's writing a world that most of us have not lived in, of being a teenager in rural west of England, right, or Wales, 1979. Everything that's ordinary and mundane and boring to her is fascinating, almost like a fantasy novel to us. And likewise, the point, I think it's in the book, but it may have been in the conversation, where she's reading about American universities as described, yes, in a science fiction novel. And she thinks this is the brilliant invention of this author. Oh, why don't they have universities like that? Only to find out that actually they are like that in America.
He was writing about the real thing.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing that she did that was funny, and it also showed you her disconnect with the real world. Because when you're talking about that she's living in a world with fairies, but to her, that world is real. I mean, those fairies are one more problem to be dealt with. She needed science fiction to get away from all the problems.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fantasy part, though, I thought was her looking at the world of Judaism, for example.
Yes.
Via the student who's Jewish. And she's like, and I marked a place and I don't know if I can find it, where she's like, well, so-and-so can't travel on Fridays or Saturdays. What happens if they break the rules? I have to ask, was it Sam? I think was his name. I have to ask Sam, what happens to them? As if it was a magical rule. And so you might be in a car accident or something.
If I try to eat Jewish food, kosher food, and I'm not Jewish, does something terrible happen to me?
Yeah. So that's her fantasy world. That's almost like stepping into a fairy kingdom, yes, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, the thing that she does so successfully there in entering into the 15-year-old mindset is that the world is very black and white. The mm-hmm. world is very much a set of rules. And if you get the rules wrong, then everything falls apart. And the rules are the rules that she learned from science fiction. But the science fiction is so wild because she's, you know, reading Robert Heinlein and Samuel Delaney at the same time. You could not imagine two more opposite views of the universe.
Sure.
And she's trying to make them both work.
Yeah, as if it's one giant set of rules.
Yep.
Right, right.
Well, is this the way Joe Walton used science fiction? Because when I was reading it, I thought, you know, I was disconnected from a lot of stuff, like most of us are when we're in teenagers in some way.
Yeah.
And I read tons of science fiction, but I didn't feel like I ever wanted to absorb the rules. Now, I understood where I was living better. I understood Judaism, even though my parents were atheists and that kind of thing. Did you guys connect with books in that way?
Well, I think that there is a point at which I became a touch uncomfortable with how – uncomfortable in the way, you know, that reading is a complete escape from reality. And I'm talking about in the book. You know, okay. I never got to the point where I felt like I was reading to escape anything, you know.
Right.
But I felt like she was, and it made me a little bit uncomfortable and actually sad. But by the end of the book – you know, especially with her, you know, the group that she started to hang out with because of books, then I started to feel like this is wonderful, you know, which is, you know, the experience that I've had in my own life. So I guess the answer is yeah, I felt like she was doing that to the point of discomfort for me, I felt uncomfortable for her, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, and that was, you know, deliberate. I think she was – that's mm-hmm. something she was trying to evoke.
Right. Yeah.
Because she's writing this on so many levels. She's writing it in the voice of the 15-year-old, but she's writing it as the 50-year-old woman who's putting the book on together.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was the thing that I felt was a bit of a I felt like that showed through, and mm-hmm. and maybe it was part of all the layers that she was putting in there,
yes.
but that stuff, and it maybe it's the 50-year-old woman, or, you know, any of us who are trying to write something about that age and we've kind of forgotten exactly mm-hmm. how you connect, because that and all the talk about lesbians and sex and all this stuff. And I'm like, I guess because I haven't been to a boarding school, that must go on and people must talk about it, notice it and stuff. But I felt like there was an unusual emphasis on all this stuff. And I was like, I get it. Move on. You know,
well, part of it. So I think that a lot of what she was saying, which we forget until we go back and look at it, is how did we learn how to become grownups? And you're learning that when you're 15 or 16. Either you're learning it because you've got a good relationship with an adult. And I was fortunate. I was very close to my parents and my father, too. 97 to this day, I'm still close to. But we had wonderful conversations every day as he would drive me to high school. That I'll never, you know, forget.
Mm-hmm.
Our character didn't have that. Where else do you learn? You learn from books. You learn from movies. You learn from TV. You go, oh, this is the way we're supposed to behave. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why it's disturbing to see behavior on TV or movies that you wouldn't want your kids to see. And, you know, the movies that actually are most dangerous for a 13-year-old to see are probably the ones rated PG-13.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can let a little kid see those. They'll wash right over them and they won't care. But for a 13-year-old to think that's the way that grown-ups are supposed to live, well, no. Actually, that's not how grown-ups are supposed to live.
Yeah.
But who's going to tell you that?
Right.
But what's funny is I feel like the kids that I actually know, a couple of kids who came from horrible backgrounds. I mean, things where I'd be hearing some of the incidents from when this kid was 5 years old, this one kid especially, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, this is like in the worst kind of movie ever. And yet, he's a straight arrow. Yeah. He basically learned from TV. He knew which families were the kind of families he wanted to be in. He was watching Cosby Show reruns. He was watching whatever. And he modeled his own life on that. And he's the only one in his family who has pulled himself out because he's like, this is what I want, and this is how I get it.
Yeah. Well, for me, the first adult books that I read were science fiction. And partly that was because in the library in the town where I grew up, there was the kids section and the grown-up section. And while I'd wait for my mom to come out of the grown-up section, the shelf of books right by the door were the science fiction books. And because people thought of science fiction as kid stuff, when you were 11 and 12, you could borrow books from the adult section that were science fiction. Now, most of the science fiction then was, you know, definitely PG rated. There was nothing.
Yeah.
But, you know, you'd get your little view of the adult world between that and peeking at the pictures of National Geographic. This was kind of how you learned how the world worked. And yet those are highly unreliable narratives as well. As a friend of mine in one of the science fiction forums I read puts it, there's a time in every science fiction fan's life when they realize that Robert Heinlein was a whole lot better at sounding like he knew what he was talking about than actually knowing what he was talking about.
Well, that's true. Yeah. Well, see, I read all kinds of stuff because my parents just didn't censor anything. And the little library that we belonged to in our tiny town was, they didn't care. My mother was there. I got to check out whatever I wanted. But I read also a lot of mysteries. And my parents had tons of books around the house. They would bring home the latest, Alfred Bester. But that was also mixed up with Josephine Tay and Agatha Christie. So I was reading all that kind of stuff. And I was a lonely kid who was a misfit nerd and everything. And I'm not saying that this book isn't valid in how it shows that, or that what you're saying isn't right and that that's how we learn about the world, because that in a sense is. But when I did my growing up was when I was in college. Mm-hmm. And I had already got that basis of science fiction and everything, and I knew about it, but nobody I knew cared about that stuff, so I just didn't talk about it. I didn't worry about it. So it's just, that's why it was interesting to me when I looked at how this person was absorbing that as ways to live. And I just thought, didn't seem realistic. Not that this book is supposed to be realistic. It is fantasy, but that's the most realistic part of it to me, was her love for books. And you do hang on to them when you're unhappy or lonely, absorb them. Go ahead.
One of the things that I've seen in the reaction to the book are a lot of people who do relate strongly to the character and say, I was exactly like that at that age. Yeah. And I'm like you. I wasn't exactly like that at that age. So for me, the charm of the book was, here's someone who wound up not that far from where I am, but got there by a totally different point, totally different mm-hmm. path.
Yeah, that's interesting. Did you know it was autobiographical before you read it?
Yes, because mm-hmm. I knew enough about Joe
to
know that, I can see that, I can see that, I can see all of this.
I see. Yeah, that's interesting.
Going back to that idea of the magic, it works so much like prayer does. Mm-hmm. I love that in the sense, too, that she was so determined not to use magic for evil or anything for selfish purposes, which, as you see her working this out, because she knew that would make her like her mother.
Yes.
Insane and bad, like the Dark Queen.
Mm-hmm.
And absolutely.
Right. Yeah, I really did enjoy that aspect of the book as well, when she started to be genuinely concerned that she had thwarted the free will of actual people and brought them together into this group of friends that may not have chosen to be her friends otherwise. And she returned to that concept a few times and really had a lot of angst about it.
And it shows that, as Christians, as people who pray, we do it so glibly. We don't really act sometimes as if this stuff is real, as if prayer really has consequences. And we should be a little more careful about how we pray, not because we're going to be, invoking the bad magic, but I think we have to take it more seriously. It's a real lesson that I, got out of my own personal spiritual life from reading the book.
Yeah, what does the prayer? Yeah, that's a good point, because you're saying that and I'm thinking, because I know if I ask for the wrong thing, God's not going to automatically give me what I want, which magic in this book, of course, is a little bit more reactual. What a dumb word.
Oh, it's reactive. A beautiful word. I love that. I should have used it.
Reactive and actual. I'm confuzzled right now. I'm just going to say it. But it reacts better. If you do the right thing, it does what you want. And that's not how prayer works. But you're right, because as Scott and I have often observed, what's internal counts too.
Yes. Yes.
It changes us. We are changing ourselves in a way that we can't see if we're doing vending machine requests for selfish things.
Mm-hmm.
Or the other thing that that she brings up in her magic system, which is that the fairies can't do it. We have to do it because we're in the real world.
Yeah.
And that sense of you want God to cure ills? Okay, what do you think you're sitting there doing? I think his agent is going to be who's going to make the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's nice. Sometimes just the act of prayer gives you that glimmer of, oh, you know, I better take care of this myself.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Which, you know, certainly you're being told that.
Mm-hmm. Somebody ought to do something.
Yeah, somebody ought to do something. God, darn it. Oh, okay.
I know. Sometimes those prayers get answered really fast. You're just like, no, I didn't want to hear that. Go, no.
Right.
That idea is wrong. The other thing I liked about her magic system was how the things would connect with the people. Like when she would go to her aunt's house and the forks and knives and things didn't want her to use them.
Yes.
Because they were used to the ants and they knew she didn't belong there. Or at the end, when she was talking about the stick and she says, whatever else it was wood, and wood loves to burn. Burning is in the pattern of wood, the potential fire that is the sun's fire. The sun was setting, but the wood leapt to flame. And then later when she's talking about Tolkien and her mother's throwing the pages at her, and what does paper want? Paper wants to become wood again because it was wood. And she does that about, I just hit a section that's all wood, but she does that about all kinds of things. And I thought, yeah, that's that underlying sense of the universe. We may take things and do various things with them, but they're always essentially what they are.
And so much of, you know, the materialist view of the world is forcing ourselves to believe that that's not true. And I cannot allow myself to believe that that's true, because then my entire materialist point of view collapses around me, and that way lies madness. You recognize eventually how much scientific materialism is wish fulfillment.
Mm-hmm. I never thought about that.
Yeah, that's interesting in the light, too, when she decided that getting earrings was going to take away her magic or her mm-hmm. mojo. And it's something that, you know, she wasn't given that information in any way. I don't recall her getting that from a book in any way. That was just there, and she knew it.
And it's a rule that she's invented for herself, but by golly, she's going to follow it.
Right, right. And she did not get those ears pierced. And that's what made her think, oh my goodness, you know, maybe my aunts are witches.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and I didn't feel like that was even a rule she invented for herself. I felt like it was one of those things that when something's happening and you're thinking, this isn't right, something's wrong, I don't know what it is, but it was an internal, natural law for her. And then of course she's fighting what we think is evil. And then she later realizes, well, you know, maybe they're not evil. Maybe they just like to be comfortable and they just don't want me bothering things. So I'll just be super nice. And it turns out that at that point seems to have worked. And you're just like, I actually kind of love that they were just kind of dull and didn't want to be bothered.
And that you can be surrounded by all the power of magic in the world and still be a boring person.
Yeah.
Just as, you know, look at us. We're living in a science fictional world where we've got the internet and computers and television and blah, 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 blah. Yeah. And we're still the same boring people that were, you know, at the time of Trollope.
Well, that's true. Well, and even when I'm looking outside at this beautiful sky and the sun's going down and the clouds are streaked with pink. And I think about how often people think, oh, I wish I could go to a planet and explore someplace really neat. And I'm like, have you looked out the window lately?
Yeah.
Because it's insanely crazy out there. There's the most entertainment in the sky you could ever want every day.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's how much do we miss because we're just keeping our heads down and not thinking.
And that's the joy, I think, of a book like this or science fiction or fantasy in general. Is that by pretending to have been set in a different time or a different place or a different kind of universe, it makes you, if it works, it wakes you up to the actual time and place and universe that you're really dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
That I think it was when I had just come back from, you know, working at the Vatican and talking to a friend of mine who had some political, you know, their aunt knew some politician who was in the news, and I'm going, I'm a character in a Madeleine L'Engle novel. Oh my gosh, how did that happen? But we're all characters in somebody's novel, and if nothing else, we're the characters in the novel that we write ourselves.
Well, that's like Sam and Frodo say, right? It's this big story, and it just keeps going and going.
And or as Bilbo once said, you know, don't adventures ever end?
Well, your part in it might. Yeah.
At the end of the trilogy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, another thing that she was talking about, you know, in Magic, when she was having the angst about controlling other people's free will, she started to be concerned that her own free will had been thwarted. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed that musing as well. You know, what if everything I do, everything I say, everything I write, absolutely everything about me was dictated by some magic somebody else will do in the future?
Like the woman who's writing this book.
Exactly. You know, oh, that is a great thought. How funny. Yeah, maybe that was Joe Walton just playing around there. That's really great.
Well, she plays so often. There are so many things in the book. Right early on, as she first shows up to her new family to see her husband, to her father, who she's never met, and the aunts. And at the beginning of the paragraph, she says, they wouldn't look at me in the eye. They'd only look at me out of the corner of the eye. And three sentences later, talking about her father, I couldn't look him in the eye.
Oh, I didn't even catch that.
Yeah, it's a book that's, you know, you can read over and over again.
Oh, one my of the gosh, things you're going to make me buy my own copy. Stop it.
There's two bits that I caught. The trilogy, the mystery trilogy, the third book also has a teenage girl in it who goes to a boarding school. Now, this is the alternate universe Britain, but she goes to the same boarding school. It's just mentioned by name.
Huh.
And it's just a little Easter egg that you have
that's
to,
neat.
To connect up on.
I love those. That's cool.
And the other is about a third of the way through the book, her grandfather, her Jewish grandfather, introduces her to Plato.
Yeah.
And she starts reading The Republic, and she goes on musing about, this would never work. You know, if I had a couple of my sister and I were in this world at age 10, we'd turn it inside out. We'd destroy it. You know, that's her new book. It's a retelling of Plato's Republic.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, how cool.
So she took that idea and actually has turned it into a book, which is, you know, coming out this month.
Oh, is that the – it has city in the title? I can't remember.
Yeah, there's the Just City.
The Just City. That's right.
Oh, yes. That makes sense.
It's a two-book set. And I read an early version of the first book, but I'm waiting to see what it turned into because I know she's changed it a lot from the version I read.
Hmm. Oh, I'll be really interested because, you know, she reminds me of two different authors One is Connie Willis,
yeah,
who I love, except I did not love her last giant All Clear, whatever it was called, Blackout and All Clear.
Now you see, I did like that. I didn't like a couple of the earlier ones, but I liked that one. Anyway, go on.
But, well, you know, let's face it. It's a lot more like this than her other books.
So. Not a lot happened.
Not much happened in there for a long time.
There's just, you know, World War II, but other than that, nothing happened.
I'm sorry. I've read a lot about World War II and seen The Dirty Dozen many a time. I don't need to.
I know what happens.
Right. Move it along.
But the other
but the other author is Diana Wynne Jones.
Yes.
And Scott, have you read?
No, I have not read Diana Wynne Jones. I've read lots of Connie Willis, but not Diana Wynne Jones.
Okay.
I'm so envious because you have a treat ahead of you.
Oh, fantastic.
And actually, yeah, because I have a friend in my book club who a couple of years ago just started going, you haven't read her? Mm-hmm. And she just started bringing me her family copies. And when I'd get done with one, she'd bring me another. And she said, now, these are all our favorites. You have to go off and find your own. So they had luckily a lot of favorites. But
wonderful. Well, where do I begin?
Oh, my. Yeah, I would say probably Howl's Moving Castle.
Okay. That's what I was going to say.
I've seen the movie, and I loved it.
Well, read the book.
I will.
Explains the title in the way the movie doesn't.
Okay.
Because the Japanese movie maker couldn't do it.
Great.
Yeah, it's different and better, and it's part of a trilogy. And I read the second book, which I liked better than Howl's Moving Castle. Mm-hmm. And there's a third one I haven't read. But
the third one I've read, which is good. They're all wonderful. Some of them are, I mean, they're all written as young adults, or most all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them aren't. Also in Diane Wynne Jones, a lot of the crazy bits, the stuff that you wouldn't believe at all, are autobiographical.
Ah.
This is like proving Mark Twain's thing, fiction has to make sense, right?
Yes.
Right.
And real life doesn't.
Real life does
Diane
not.
Diane Wynne Jones was the daughter of a pair of school teachers who neglected the kids, and the kids essentially raised themselves.
Oh.
A number of the schools that she describes in her books that you go, no one would ever run a school like this. That's autobiographical.
Yeah, the one that's one of the Crestomancy books where they're one of the kids learns he can do magic or something. I can't remember where all the sneakers disappear, and
yeah,
can't remember the name of the book now, but it was not a great place. Yeah. Oh. Anyway, so there are a lot of elements like that, although since her books are directed usually to younger readers, as you said, she's focusing on a simpler story, mm-hmm. and getting to the point a little quicker. But this one actually made me think of one of the books that I couldn't quit reading, but it drove me the craziest by the time I got to the end, which was A Tale of Time City.
Yes.
Which is in and out and things are happening and you don't know what they are. And somehow while a lot of things were happening, you felt like nothing was happening. I don't know. It was the weirdest book. But the main thing is when you kept saying that Joe Walton will say, I'm going to write about Plato's Republic if me and my sister, the magic was there, or I'll, this among others and all this kind of thing. I read a sample on the Kindle. I didn't realize she'd written a book about writing, The Magic of Writing, I think it's called, which is all these essays of talks that she's given or she had given.
This is Diane Wynne Jones.
Diana Wynne Jones, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And Diana Wynne Jones had a beautiful essay at the very beginning that you would love, Scott, where she talks about the children in the wood, and she talks about looking out her window and watching children play in the woods. Groups of girls are playing things where they're queens. Groups of boys are crawling around under bushes and shooting each other and dying. And she says, but it all starts off with one idea. Let's pretend. So let's pretend a dog is a dog star. What would happen?
Yes.
Is the dog star. Let's pretend this castle can walk. What would happen? Let's pretend. So I thought that's that similar quality here in the Among Others. It's not honed in exactly the way that, fits my mind the most comfortably, like a hand in a glove. Mm-hmm. But I could really appreciate all the flashes in this book that I saw of the things that you, Brother Guy, summed up so well as, like how I think of prayer and how this works, or how the universe works and how that magic system is, or the really beautiful ending, which left me both kind of cheering and almost crying about I'm going to live my life.
Yeah.
Hold on. Because
one of the key things that you mentioned, you started out talking about the essays that Joe Walton and she's the one who invented the word that we needed so long to describe how science fiction and fantasy works, which is why people who aren't into it hate it. And the word is incluing.
Yes.
And I have to explain what incluing is. You've created a universe that's different from our universe. How do you communicate this to the reader? How do you tell them the rules of the universe? And there's the classic wrong way to do it is to have one character say to the other, well, as you know, Bob.
The info dump.
Right. You can't take much of that. Right.
And what, among others, is an exercise in incluing.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's writing, she's showing you the journal of a girl who's in the middle of this universe. And you have to, part of the puzzle is you have to figure out how the universe works and how reliable is she or isn't she. And what are the rules that she has assumed and hasn't said? Because at the end of the day, all of us are living in universes where we've made all sorts of assumptions about how the world works that we haven't been paying attention to those assumptions.
Right.
And we just assume that, of course, it works that way. And anyone who disagrees with me must be crazy.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, of course there's no such thing as fairy, or of course those fairies are actually ghosts, or,
Or it's all in your mind. In the immortal words of Dumbledore, just because it's all in your mind doesn't mean it isn't true.
I have leaned on that many a time.
Oh, yes.
Well, and that was one of her best essays in that book about books, which what makes this book so great. Because I have to say, it's a funny thing is, you know, like I said, this isn't my favorite book, but I wanted it to be my favorite book. Mm-hmm. And then after I read What Makes This Book So Great, I went back to Tor.com and just started working my way backward through every book review she'd written.
Yes.
And I loved how she wrote them so much. Joe Walton, I hope you listen to this because I love your reviews so much, by the way.
And they're her. She's a writer who's not afraid to put herself on the page.
Right, because I also
knew that's such an important quality, man.
Yeah. I also knew we'd have so many arguments because I couldn't agree with her about a lot of things.
but she doesn't want you to agree with her.
Well, and the thing was, I was like, yeah, but the feeling you got through those essays was she'd be perfectly happy to sit there with a cup of tea or a scotch or whatever is her pleasure, and we could just amiably laugh at each other and throw each other's books across the room all night, and it would still be fine.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So that's what I liked about, you know, all those. So anyway, Scott, I'm sorry. I just kept blah, blah, blah.
No. It's wonderful. But yeah, I enjoyed the book quite a bit. And why does the Litany Against Fear work? We got to determine that before we end.
Yes. Oh. And the fact that she, you know, pulls it out of Dune.
Yes.
A science fiction novel.
Well, that's like the St. Michael prayer.
Yeah. Exactly.
I've leaned on that so many. I mean, I'll have these really horrible dreams that feel extremely real, and there's this terrible sense of evil, and I'll wake up and just be terrified. And I am leaning on that or other various litanies that all connect me to God, because I know it's like her.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have something that connects you but also protects you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
What I found in my life as a scientist and talking about science and religion is that when people say they don't believe in God, it's because what they think God is, they don't believe in. And guess what? I don't believe in that either.
I found it so very similar to that. You know, the God that they don't believe in seems to be a straw God that other people have made up.
And that's, you know, that's, they don't realize that what we all have experienced, you know, I've never been a 15-year-old girl in Wales, but I can relate to the character in this book because she has experienced the same things that I have. And the irony is that everybody feels like they're alone and that there's this rest of the world. I don't know who the rest of the world people are. I've never run into any of them. But this is what it means to be 15. It means to be that you are among others, but they are other, and you're just among them.
Mm.
And that it's okay.
Yeah. Not only that, but when you connect up and realize that you can find people you can talk to, whether it's about science fiction or football or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Another book that I'll throw out, another author I'll throw out that she reminds me of, is Francis Spufford.
I don't know that one.
And he's a British writer, and everything he's written is wonderful, and everything he's written is different. But he wrote a book, The Child That Books Made, which is specifically autobiographical. And his growing up was, he had wonderful parents. He had an older sister who had a fatal disease. And she took all of the energy and all of the attention of the family and couldn't help but. And he didn't resent it. He, you know, loved his sister. He cried when she died. But as a kid, it meant that he had to graze himself because the parents were so concerned about the sister. And it's nobody's fault. It's just the way the world worked. So, you know, he talks about the books that made him and how books allowed him to grow up. He wrote another book, which I think you would enjoy, called Unapologetic.
Unapologetic?
Yes, which is his expression of his Christian faith.
Oh, I think did that just come out?
It came out in Britain a couple of years ago. I don't know if it's out in this country yet.
The American edition just came out because I got a review copy. I have it somewhere here that says because of Happy Catholic, my blog. But because he says at the beginning, he says some of this isn't going to make sense to Americans. Let me explain why. you guys have a lot more religion. You guys are more tolerant of that kind of thing than people here. So I'm having to go further back and all that kind of thing. So yep. I'll have to move that closer to the top of my stack.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wonderful.
I love the things that he's written. One of the great things of my life that I spend part of the year in Europe is I go through London whenever I can and pick up books that if you don't get there, you can't get.
Oh, yeah.
That would be great.
That would be great.
There are some wonderful fantasy novels. That's where I discovered Diana Wynne Jones. That's where I discovered Frances Bufford. There is a fantasy writer, and I'm going to blank on his name. I think it's Stephen Baxter, wrote a young adult time travel novel called The H-Bomb Girl. It's the only one I can think of off the top of my head where the main character is not the time traveler, but the time travelee.
Oh.
The one who encounters the time travelers in her own little world, which is dull and mundane. And, you know, she's in this, you know, not in the center of action at all. She's in this dumpy town called Liverpool in 1962. Of course, nothing interesting is going on.
No.
Nice. Yeah, I just confirmed while you were talking there. It is Stephen Baxter, the H-Bomb Girl. Excellent.
Okay. And again, I don't know if that's available in America, but I got that in Britain and loved it.
Oh, nice, nice.
Man.
Yep.
I know, just when you think the world is a really small place and everything's the same everywhere, then you remember British science fiction or various mysteries and things. You go, no, it isn't. I want those.
Yes, and that's part of the charm of it. In some ways, Britain is a fantasy novel. You know, some people want to say that it's a theme park, but it is a fantasy novel. And it's one of the things that makes it so wonderful to travel there. And they feel the same way about America, which is why they love coming here.
That's what I liked in the book when she was saying, oh, my gosh, these people are going to – maybe this one isn't going to – this con is going to be in America.
Right.
You know?
That's funny.
They just went to Florida.
What could be more exciting than to be in wherever it is you are?
Yeah. Neil Gaiman, American Gods, I read some about, you know, him writing that book. And it's kind of exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
This is a fantasy land over here.
And, you know, something as simple as the first time I went to Britain and realized, here I am, I'm an adult, and I don't know how to make the telephones work. You know, back in the days of button A and slot B or whatever, which they don't have anymore. Or walking into a room and you keep flipping the light switch the wrong way because the convention is different.
Yeah, those little things.
Wow, yep. Wonderful, wonderful. Before we close here, I wanted to be sure to ask you if you had any particular favorite pieces of science fiction to recommend of your lifetime of reading. Do you have any particular favorites?
I do. You have to understand that as an astronomer, I don't go into the heavy science because that's life. That's my work.
Sure, sure.
I'm much more into the adventure stories, the sword and sorcery, the space opera. A book that I absolutely loved, though it's got plot holes galore, and there's absolutely no reason why it should work, but it does, was a book by an author named James Schmitz. And the book is The Witches of Caries.
Okay.
How do you spell Caries?
K-A-R-R-E-S. And it was based on a short story he wrote in 1949 that he expanded into a novel in the late 50s, early 60s. It's not particularly long. It's not particularly deep or profound. But it's an awful lot of fun. And one of the things that Schmitz did was writing at the time he did, just after the Golden Age. You know the old joke about when was the Golden Age of science fiction?
14, right.
Yeah. but writing in the 50s, he could take a lot of the tropes and turn them inside out and take the things that you would expect and say, well, in reality, this is the way it actually would work. But he does it with great, great charm and great aplomb. But part of the theme of that book is it's the character thrown into an adventure not of his own making, where he's mistaken to be somebody who's got special powers and discovers, well, I guess I'm going to have those powers, or at least, you know, have the equivalent of them, which is what growing up is.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Of the current writers, I do love Connie Willis. I love the Bujold books. She wrote the Curse of Chelion, which I reread once a year.
Oh, we're going to talk about that sometime, Scott.
Wonderful.
That's
wonderful.
The most amazing book.
Yeah, yes. My wife loves Bujold. I've read the Verkhozagans. I've read the first one just recently.
Some of them are great. Some of them are okay. And then the key one of that series is Memory, which you can't read until you've read the ones before. But once you read the ones before, you realize this is the nub that the entire series spins around.
All right.
And how she's able to write every book that works as a standalone and yet have the arc through the 15 or so in the series is remarkable of writing.
Nice.
She's another one who she's on Goodreads actively, and she writes book reviews on there.
Oh.
Of what she's been, and a lot of science books is what she likes to read. And so you just read those, and it's not, of course, the same as Joe Walton, but in that sense of, here's what I think about it. It is exactly the same, and they're really a pleasure if you haven't come across them.
Mm-hmm. Have you read the, since you apparently have a taste, as I do, for young adult and children's books, have you read the Patricia Reedy's books, the Dragon books, Talking to Dragons?
I read the one that was a conversation between her and what other author where they wrote the letters back
up. Oh, the Red Letters. Yes, yes. Those are very great fun.
Like Cecilia and Sorcery and the Enchanted Teapot or something.
Yeah,
she's written, but not the others.
She's written a number of books that I really like. Her most recent series doesn't work for me. It just doesn't grab me. But a lot of her earlier stuff does. So that's another writer too.
Excellent. Okay.
And finally, just in terms of sheer space opera, at the moment, nobody does it better than Steve Miller and Sharon Lee.
Oh, my gosh. We are truly soulmates, Brother Guy.
I'll tell you the best part about being a Jesuit at the Vatican Observatory is that they want to meet me. I had a chance to meet them, and you know, here I am there at a convention, and do I dare go up and say, "Oh, I'm your big fan"? And Steve Miller is thinking, "That's Brother Guy." Do I dare go up and say, "I'm your big fan"? It was wonderful.
I love it. You've gotten to meet them. I'm so jealous.
I have actually met them too. They were at a local convention here several years ago, but I have not read them, so I need to.
Oh,
yeah,
you need to.
I really do. I did enjoy them.
I'll send you a list. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, the starter drug is probably Fledgling.
Fledgling, okay.
It's in the middle of the series, but it was written only a few years ago. And so, I mean, their first books are fine, but they're still learning how to write.
Far be it from me to disagree. Oh, wait, I'm going to. I'll send you a list, Scott.
Sure. And I can tell you everything that's wrong with those books because I've read them all five times.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You had to read them that many times just to be sure your list was correct, right?
Exactly.
Well, and that's the thing is my mother and sister and I discovered those books when they only had the first two or three out.
Mm-hmm.
And so they thought they were never going to write anymore. You couldn't really find them. And a reprint came out and we all went, oh, and so we grabbed the trilogy all printed as one and all read it several times. Mm-hmm. And then they started writing more and we went, oh my gosh. So I have a love for those that is irrational because. Mm-hmm.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah.
So do you often attend Worldcon, Brother Guy?
I do. I try to get to the Worldcon every time I can. It's not every year, but, I was at the one in London last year, and I will be at Sasquan.
Oh, in Spokane?
In Spokane. Mm-hmm. I, this past year, won the Carl Sagan Medal, which is
wonderful. Yes, that's runner. Right. Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Part of the deal is you have to give a public talk. So I've arranged to give my public talk at the World Science Fiction Convention.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful.
Sweet.
Well, that's just up the road for me, so I'm going to really try to get there.
Oh, absolutely.
I've been to one Worldcon. This may interest people, I hope. I used to have a feeling that fandom was hostile to religious folk, partly because of the things I was reading.
Don't believe everything you read.
Yeah. So then I've been to one Worldcon. It was LA Con, was it 2001, 2000? No, it was after that, 2006 or something like that. Yes. Anyway, I was there and I remember looking through the program and there was a multi-denominational service on Sunday morning at the convention.
Yes.
And I went
yes.
there and there was a priest there and a Presbyterian, I believe. Mm-hmm. It was really nice. I thought it was great.
I was at the one of the Chicago conventions and sort of wandering around on a Saturday morning, rushing someplace. And if you've looked at me, especially back then, all the hair that's gray now was red then, and I've got this big bushy hair and this big bushy beard.
Uh-huh.
And one of them looks up and says, "Oh, you're probably somebody we can use. We need one more for a minion." I go, "Nope." But absolutely, because how can you not be fascinated by religion if you're fascinated by fantasy? And the thing that, you know, science fiction did for me, the thing that C.S. Lewis did for me in the Narnia books, which I read while I was in college for the first time, is they made me realize that religion was fun, that it is the true part of every fantasy novel.
Hmm. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's when people aren't being honest about religion one way or the other, either for or against,
yep.
that it rings so false.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you can spot it immediately.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Whenever you write something with an agenda like that, it's easy to see.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah,
there's
that's
a writer.
I love their discussion, Tolkien and Lewis on myth and things like that. We've discussed that before on the podcast, and mm-hmm. you know, I just don't get enough of it. I really enjoy talking about that because I think I view the world the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot to be said about science fiction and religion. I've written about it. I've had a couple of things published in U.S. Catholic. And they've got an article of mine that they'll run one of these days that lists a few of the religious science fiction. And it's religious like Tolkien is religious. Religion, the word never shows up.
Right.
Religion is everywhere.
Yeah.
Or the movie Interstellar.
You know,
religion never shows up. The movie is entirely about religion.
Or gravity.
Gravity, right.
Yeah.
Same.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and in fact, thinking about the honesty for religion, you know, because you can tell, just to go back to the book for a second, one of the things I did want to mention is you can tell she's not anti-religious or, you know, hostile, I guess, because of the thing she said about that book, The Dark is Rising.
Yes.
She says, "There's a thing in The Dark is Rising, the Christmas one, which is definitely the best of them, where Will does magic in a church, and the vicar asks about the magic crosses, and they say they're before Christ, and he says, but not before God." And then a little later, "In children's books with magic, everything is always very black and white, though not, of course, in Tolkien. But not before God made me think."
Yep.
And I was like, that rang so true to me,
yep. mm-hmm.
but it also is just tossed off there as something for anybody to think about. And that's very honest.
Yeah.
And that was a wonderful quality.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I really like that aspect of it.
It's in some ways it's valuable because it's someone from the outside shining a light on the things in our lives, which we sometimes take for granted.
Oh yeah.
I'm reminded of the writer Simone Weil, who, you know, never actually became a Christian, but was one of the great Christian writers of the. This is not the French politician. This mm-hmm. is the mystic from World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I've yep. never read any of her stuff, but I always hear her quoted, and then I'll yep. always see people saying, as you say, "Well, she wasn't, you know, died without being Christian." And I'm like, "How do you do that?"
Yeah, well, but
this is so right.
She was.
Well, yeah, she had baptism by desire, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
Which of course ends up with my wonderful line that someone gave me, which I will happily steal on: "Would you baptize an extraterrestrial?" And the question: "Well, what happens if they react badly with water? You pour water over them and they burst into flame." Well, it's baptism by fire and water at the same time.
Take your choice.
I never did understand why the aliens showed up on the Earth in the first place. If they were allergic to water.
Yeah, really.
When they just say, you know, Mars is looking pretty good. Well, there's water there too, right?
A classic example of you had one job, you know?
Yep. Oh, I love it. I love
it.
Well, brother guy, this has been an absolute pleasure. I greatly appreciate your joining us for our 100th episode. You sure made it special, and I sure enjoyed this. So thank you very, very much.
It's a delight to run into people who love books as much as I do.
Well, thank you so much, because it really was fun, and I really enjoyed getting to know you during this little time we had together.
Well, hope we run into each other at a WorldCon.
You bet.
I'm thinking Canada might happen.
All right. Sounds wonderful. Okay. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. Here's to another 100 episodes.
That's right. So we'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye, everybody.